So hi everyone, welcome to this talk on women's oppression and care work. My name is Emily. I'm gonna be the moderator for this discussion. The way that we're gonna do it is each of our speakers is gonna introduce themselves and give remarks, approximately 15 to 20 minutes, and then we'll have an open discussion, Q&A, whatever we feel like. So with that,
yeah,
go ahead.
Hi everyone, I'm Marta. I come from Croatia and I'm an independent researcher in the field of economic history or labor history, and my everyday job is I'm a film curator and I run an illegal feminist cinema, so that's it. Yeah, and I'm gonna give you this little or short talk is gonna be about some specificities of the connection between political and economic crises and women mass labor migrations in two different historical periods. So it's like some outline of my current research, and basically it's a comparative analysis of two important episodes in the history of female migrations: the migrations that took part from Slovenia to Egypt in the late 19th century, and the migration from Southeast Europe to Italy in the 90s, in the last century. So those historical phenomena are observed within the theoretical framework of theory of social reproduction. And that theory, it's basically the theory which postulates a structural link between capitalism and patriarchy, and is really attentive to the political economy of neoliberal economic policies that result in the commodification of care. So my research is structured around two migration phenomena, as I said. Those are Alexandrinke, or Alexandrian women, and Badante. The phenomenon of Alexandrinke refers to the massive decades-long migration of women from Western Slovenia to Egypt, primarily to Alexandria, Cairo, and Port Said, where they worked as care workers, vet nurses, nurses, and governesses. The migration began in the last quarter of the 19th century and lasted until approximately Second World War. Other phenomenon is Badante, that is Italian word for care worker, and it is mainly used for migrant workers in Italian households, and those are primarily workers in elderly care. In my research, I'm focused on women migrating from the former Yugoslavia, primarily from the northwestern Croatian region of Istria, that is North Adriatic, close to the Italian border. And that took place during, that started during the war in the 90s, but today it's like, it's going on nowadays. In the case of Alexandrinke, the proximity of the port of Trieste and the construction and opening of the Suez Canal are the conditions that motivated this mass emigration of women to Egypt from Slovenian regions in the west. They're mainly poorly populated rural area, and but the economic reasons were the primary reason to emigrate, but the migrations to Alexandria, which has since the late 18th century been an important trading center with strong international shipping industry. Later, when the construction of the Suez Canal began, the families of engineers who moved to Egypt to work on the construction created a new demand for a female workforce. So many women from the above-mentioned areas spent a long time in Egypt working, as I mentioned, wet nurses, nannies, ladies' companions, or caretakers. And the migration was ongoing between the second half of the 19th century to the and the Egyptian Revolution in the 1952, and was above all motivated by economic reasons, as I said. The mostly rural population was afflicted by extreme poverty and agrarian backwardness, and the situation was later further worsened by fascist regime and the strong process of Italianization when these areas became a part of the Kingdom of Italy between 1980 and liberation in 1943. So, as could be expected, the long-running emigration of generations of women from this poorly populated Slovenian rural area had far-reaching social consequences. So the entry of women into the labor market and their taking over the role of household breadwinners in a context marked by a highly patriarchal Catholic rural environment has been for a long time tabooed, so indicating its complexity and the social upset the phenomenon caused and which it still provokes. So women's participation in the labor market or women's financial independence redefines the traditional gender roles and changes in some way women's identity. The migrants replace difficult physical agrarian work with care work in a completely new culture. So women's work continued to be within the private sphere, traditionally imposed on and intended for women, but now it transformed from unpaid reproductive labor into, in some sense, a means of emancipation. So the research into the Alexandrinka phenomenon is taken from vantage point of feminist political economy, Marxist feminism, and the theory of social reproduction, and it aims, among other things, to detect and interpret the causes and consequences of the mass female labor migrations in the context of emerging modern nations, as well as its ambivalent position in the process of reproduction of patriarchal and capitalist society. So at the same time, there in Egypt, they represent the respectable and needed migrant workforce, while back home they are stigmatized as immoral and failed mothers, although in the both cases their role, as I said, remains the same, that is, reproduction of society. So by analyzing the context of these historical episodes, we can draw parallels between the effects of neoliberal economic policies and the process of repatriarchalization that under certain conditions follows in their wake, since the type of economic system that, like capitalism, largely depends on free reproductive work also often seeks ideological support in conservative, nationalistic and patriarchal principles. In my research, one of the aims is to emphasize in the relation to the recent cases of massive female migrations, like the above mentioned Badante, the effects of informal and insecure form of employment, mostly in the domain of black market, which emerge especially in the times of crisis. Such comparative analysis as this one seeks to relate older historical phenomena to the contemporary trend of commodification of care and feminization of migration. So I think there is a whole range of parallels we can draw between the experience of Alexandrinka and present-day female labor migrations. Firstly, both contemporary and past migrations are examples of asymmetrical economic strength of different regions, characteristic of capitalist development. Secondly, on the level of social experience, several analogous phenomena should be mentioned. Contemporary female labor migrants are accompanied by the stigma of being too independent, sexually loose women, just Alexandrinka were a century ago. There was a significant increase in alcoholism among the unemployed husbands of Alexandrinka, which can fruitfully be related to the contemporary crisis of masculinity that appears in such for patriarchal gender dichotomy, extraordinary circumstances of gender roles inversion when the woman becomes the breadwinner. So we have some recent research in Europe. Rosa Luxemburg Stiftung commissioned the research about austerity measures impact on women. So we have like all the same effects which we can compare to those 100 years ago. So additionally, it is also important to look at the role of the informal network of referrals and acquaintances during the search for employment, typical for both Alexandrinka and modern migrants. Those are primarily family ties, but also connections via religious organizations. And those religious organizations don't just serve as an employment bureau, but also as some kind of social reproduction activities for those women, like places for their emotional support, spending their free time. And there is, in this new book, that Titi Bacharaya edited on social reproduction theory. There is like research on Filipino women working in Canada, and their main reference point is also some church religious organization. So furthermore, contemporary caregivers often retire themselves and, having served as breadwinners for several generations of their family, decide to pursue illegal migrant work, among other reasons because of the danger of losing their insufficient pensions. That is similar to Alexandrinka case, after spending decades in Egyptian households, would return to Slovenia, where they lived on social assistance in abandoned homes or public homeless shelters, since due to their informal employment they had not been granted pension. I think it is also important to look at the age structure of earlier and current migrants, as we can see from the example of Alexandrinka, who at some point had a well-organized social infrastructure in Egypt, in the form of kindergartens or boarding school that enable them that enable them as working mothers to bring their children to Egypt. So the latter problem points to the one of the key implications that I would try to one of the key implications of my research project that I would like to examine, that is the arguments for and possibility of socialization of reproductive work. Having in mind the nearly universal contemporary policy of austerity measures and cuts in social services, I think it is no coincidence that present-day migrant caregivers are mostly elderly, retired women themselves. The well-known paradox of female emancipation resulting from the enter into the labor market registers as the later problem of subsequent double oppression. As women participate in the labor market, there appears the question of necessary reproductive work, which is extremely important for a market economy. In order to reproduce capitalism, it is not enough just to ensure exploitation of labor. Unpaid work in the household sphere that reproduces labor force, I think it's also imperative. So it is therefore crucial for the creation of surplus value that this work is and remains free, or in the sphere of informal economy. That fact makes migrant workers in a household, which still represent the majority of women's migrant work, particularly invisible due to the nature of the work itself, as well as their often unregulated migrant status. For the capitalist mode of production, it is characteristic to commodify housework and care work. That means work necessary for the reproduction of labor force, or reduce it to the level of individual responsibility. Though tendencies in the direction of commodifying care and towards gradual decline in available social services can be followed for decades back, the consequences of such measures are especially apparent in the periods of crisis. Cuts in social services and austerity measures affect women much more, because they use these services more often and take on more paid and unpaid work to compensate for cuts in the public sector. That is, the changes in the productive sphere have impacts on reproductive sphere. They are like mutually connected. While some wealthy families might even be able to pay for private sector care work by employing people who work and live in the same household as their employers, those workers are often women who emigrated to support and feed their own families. So we are talking in the terms of global care chains. Domestic workers are in general significantly less paid than workers in other industries, and often work in extremely exploitative working conditions. So on a global scale, such privatized solutions continue to perpetuate women's exploitation and reproduce a gender-based global division of labor. The phenomenon of feminization of migration should be examined in the context of the consequences of economic neoliberalism, deindustrialization, disintegration of the welfare state, and so on. But even though it has been termed a phenomenon only recently, the experience of Alexandrinka shows that the mass female migrations are not a new development, but a long-standing rule in the times of political and economic crisis. That means, consequently, crisis of social reproduction. So, the phenomenon of Aleksandrinke has so far attracted attention mostly by Slovene scholars, and mostly from ethnographic, sociological, and anthropological perspectives, and there is an important corpus of work, but there doesn't exist a wealth of research that focuses on current contemporary migrations of women from Croatia to Italy during starting from the 90s. And the few individual contributions to that topic that have appeared have focused on different aspects of the phenomenon, like the relation between clients and care workers. But so having this in mind, my primarily aim is to research these phenomenons from political perspective of political economy and economic history. So I think in the context of mentioned feminization of migration, it seems important to point out to the continuity of this phenomenon by feminization. So I will conclude with this. As I said, in the context of the mentioned feminization of migration, it seems important to point out to the continuity of this phenomenon by researching the history of female labor migration, and so acquire a new insights which would also help to understand contemporary developments. And I think looking into the past, we can think about crisis of care or crisis of social reproduction in terms of constant crisis, which is like inherent to the capitalist mode of production. So those are some things I want to discuss. Yeah, thank you.
So I guess I will be next. My name is Edna Bonon, and I am currently living in Berlin, Germany, and I've been organizing with Frauenstreik, which is part of the International Women's Strike in Germany, as well as a member of a union, the GEW, which is an education and scientist researchers union, and a postdoctoral fellow and historian. So I won't be speaking in my capacity as what my research usually is, but rather as someone who's been actively working with feminist organizations and groups in Europe, and making sense of a kind of rise of the far right and its relationship to femo-nationalism more broadly, as well as what kind of alternatives there people are trying to offer. But before I start, I wanted to thank my co-panelists and also the moderator for this opportunity. And as I said, over the course of the talk, I'll try to think about and outline some concrete things that have been happening. So first, on the 9th of October 2018, Nicole Horst, a member of the far-right nationalist party Alternative for Deutschland, stated, quote, "I believe we are the only party in Germany who is really fighting for women's rights, because we point out we're in danger of losing the freedom and rights of women for which we fought for centuries," end quote. She said this concerning her alleged concerns about Muslim women being married off at early ages or being subjected to honor killings. And I put that in quotes, honor killings, mostly because this is a racialized way in Germany to talk about femicide, which is a real issue, but not necessarily, it's actually mostly amongst the white Germans of Christian background, not necessarily Muslim people. And yet this is the kind of advocacy that AfD, or Alternative for Deutschland, is using as a premise vis-a-vis the name of women's rights. So this combination of German women allegedly speaking on the behalf of women's rights is not unique. In fact, many European liberals, secularists, and far-right politicians have instrumentalized women's rights and feminism to encroach upon religious freedom, women's bodies, and migration under a banner of what people call femo-nationalism. And that term is coined by Sarah Ferris, who uses this term to describe the xenophobic and both Islamophobic perspectives that often curtail with neoliberal policies. In Europe, one major arena that this happens is on the question of corporeality and the dress of Muslim women, and is also with respect to labor simultaneously, as well as within education.
For example, Dr. Elisa Bonfi has noted countries such as Switzerland have instituted burqa bans in the name of women's rights, even though they have dilatory and grant, they were very dilatory in granting women suffrage and parity for Swiss women. So it wasn't until 1971 that women in Switzerland were allowed to vote, and not until 1997 that gender parity was actually provided again in Switzerland at a national level. One German court also prevented a Muslim teacher from wearing a headscarf, which left her temporarily unemployed, and she was reassigned to another institution. In North Rhine-Westphalia in Germany, the government is on a defense after a plan to legally ban girls living in Germany from wearing headscarves in schools, which is a very similar approach in public schools in France today. And this is this particular initiative is kind of goes against Germany's alleged anti-discrimination laws on the one hand, but it's also something that is emerging in the context of the rise of the Christian Democratic Union and the Free Democratic Party coalition currently. In Bavaria and southern Germany, which is very heavily Catholic, their constitutional court has confirmed that the legitimacy of their state to ban judges or prosecutors from wearing the headscarf. So that is to say, a person who is trained as a judge, a Muslim woman is trained as a judge and decides to wear a headscarf, she cannot practice law and she cannot be a judge. And it is said, in vis-a-vis this Bavarian law, that in the presence of crosses and yarmulkes, that they also allegedly forbid against this. But this is something, this particular law and the way in which it's being put forth does go against the general religious freedom and equality in the German state, especially given its history with the Holocaust and anti-Semitism. So I bring up these different points and examples just to show how the legal system in the German state, as well as elsewhere, has tried to ban religious clothing for public servants, people who then are barred from employment and potentially other opportunities. If these feminists were really concerned, in my opinion, about women's rights, they would not be controlling women's bodies during their labor process, and they would not dictate the behavior of people in the composition. So this is something to take note. At the same time, femo-nationalism in the German context, as well as more broadly in Europe, is a wellspring for white nationalism and often under the banner of secularism, specifically as outlined with the cases in which government officials and public laws prohibit the use of religious expressions. And so this also dovetails with what Gayatri Spivak, a subaltern scholar, has noted, where British colonialists in India justified colonization because they saw themselves as, quote, saving brown women from brown men, end quote, a phenomenon which percolates by nationalist and far-right groups in Europe today. So how can we understand these racialized comments, these racialized policies in the context of European nationalism, and why is it important to talk about it now? I would say that in a moment in which very explicit racist, anti-Semitic, Islamophobic attacks have been happening, and the European Union issued a discrimination report indicating that it has increased since 2015, a kind of turning point for the economic or the refugee migration from the Middle East and North Africa and more beyond. And it is important to hone in on how feminists or people who are speaking under the banner of feminists, whatever that might mean for them, have been using full right-wing populism to halt migration and to halt people who might be perceived as migrants. As this brand of populism has soared in recent years, it is also attempted to rebrand itself to appeal to a new generation of voters. So Marine Le Pen, through very concerted efforts in the last election, French elections, they have a youth wing, and they've also had a youth wing that is trying to address the issue of austerity in many cases. And there's one particular video in which one youth was saying, well, why is it that these refugees get all these benefits and we don't? As opposed to thinking about the issue around the state and, you know, thinking about neoliberalism and how it's really impacted France, a lot of the blame vis-a-vis Le Pen's party and other far-right parties has often gone to recent migrants or those who are perceived as migrants. In addition to that, the rise of the far-right party has generated a litany of self-described feminists who purport nationalism, coordinating from Scandinavia to Southern Europe. And so some of those parties being the Swedish Democrats, Swiss Party, People's Party, and an Alternative for Germany, or Alternative for Deutschland, who jettisoned themselves from the centrist parties by championing themselves by for the Burgonian women members. And in some cases, they've even formed women's sections. So Alice Wiedel and Beatrix von Storch have, with the Alternative for Deutschland, have formed and inaugurated Frauen in der Alternative oder Frieda, or Frieda, a working group that aims to increase women's voters in their party structure. So currently, their party membership, last year, the women representation of AfD was about 13%, and this year it's about 18-19%. And so groups like Frieda are actively aiming to recruit in a way that Die Linke, the far left, the left party, has not actually. And so some of the AfD members actually went so far to say in their language of the far right, have actually incorporated the language of Me Too movement, and yet they hold many non-white members or women in contempt. And so this contradiction by, on the one hand, using the Me Too language and discourse when it was started by black women, but on the other hand, very much vilifying women of color, migrants, Muslim women, is part and central to what they're doing. So their position is entrenched in anti-Islam rhetoric that reproduces what I would say is actually anti-feminist, and it's also tied to both productive and social reproductive forces. Concerning the reproductive forces, far-right women have also upheld very oppressive anti-abortion campaigns that have heightened from pre-existing legislation. So for example, two specific laws that have had a Nazi holdover and that currently hold today are Article 218 and Article 219A in Germany, where Article 218 states that abortion is murder, that's in the German constitution, and that's a holdover of Nazi law from the 30s. And Article 219A specifically makes it illegal for healthcare providers to advertise, inform, or advise anyone about abortion. So if someone, a healthcare provider, says that they provide abortions on their website, on a pamphlet, they can be fined or face jail time for that. And 2 years ago, a doctor in Germany went through a court case because of this, and it's still being contested. In Poland, anti-abortion groups have likened the morning after pill as the early abortion pill, in quotes, calling for stricter restrictions on abortions. And in Ireland, pro-choice activists organized walkouts opposed the abortion ban and eventually were able to have a win last year. And these accounts are not an anomaly, but these are standard contestations between conservative far-right groups and the ways in which they try to modify, regulate, and restrict what women or queer bodies can do. Outside of that, these positions are rooted vis-a-vis the AfD as well as other groups about nativist ideas and anxieties about being replaced, in quotes, by foreigners. So Alice Wiedel, one of the major leaders of the AfD in Germany, in parliament last year made a claim that the German population is decreasing, but not the Muslim population, and we need to, quote, do something about it. In Poland, Poland is also giving more money to have more babies, particularly to white Polish people of Christian descent. And France has had concessions for the Famille Noble for ages. So this is not a kind of thing that's unique to one nation state per se, but very much happening throughout Europe. So because I'm a historian, I'll talk a little bit about history and then go to the kind of case of what is being done on the ground in Germany. So of course, the history of feminism is full of traditions that have left some women behind. So while some groups like Clara Zetkin and Rosa Luxemburg have, from the early like 20th century, advocated for full suffrage and political representation, German feminists such as Helen Stoka and others had advocated for eugenics and particularly for Hebung die Rasse, which is the raising of the race. And in the US, Margaret Sanger, the founder of what is now called Planned Parenthood, was very much about expressing eugenicist policies alongside with birth control and contraceptive policies, particularly targeting towards working class women, poor women, women of color. Even more, so one of the things that I guess, given that history, that one can think about is how is it that one can, at this point, challenge femo-nationalism, and how do we think about that vis-a-vis current movements today? So I would say that the resurgence of an international feminist movement vis-a-vis Frauenstreik in Germany, or the International Women's strike is one iteration. So this year in Germany, 25,000 people demonstrated for Frauenstreik in Berlin alone, and thousands more in small cities in Stuttgart and Dresden and others. And this year also marked the first time in Berlin, not in all of Germany, that March 8th was a public holiday. And on one hand, it's great that people had that day off, but it also meant that people had to really sharpen the political acuity of the holiday to actually make links between reproductive work, productive work, and how to have solidarity actions. So what that had meant is that there were various groups of people protesting, having sit-ins, strikes, etc. And on that day when I asked Ruth, the 33-year-old hostel worker, why she was protesting, she indicated, quote, "I think my boss is a sexist," end quote. And as I walked through the Berlin with various contingents, but particularly migrant women and refugee contingent, they held signs of "no one is illegal," and they very much politicized their participation to deepen and integrate an autonomous, leftist, pro-choice, and anti-racist perspective. Preceding that particular movement on March 8th in Germany, there were various strike actions whereby women editors of Neue Deutschland, a leftist German newspaper, which has some small affiliation with the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation, Stiftung, went on strike on the prior day, on the 7th, and they left blank columns on the newspaper to show the power of their labor. So that was a symbolism vis-a-vis journalists, particularly women journalists, who have a pay disparity of 21%. And so what they were demanding outside of that strike on March 7th and also March 8th was for comprehensive transparency of salary and permanent jobs for the freelance journalists who also have precarious labor. In addition to that strike action, the strike actions around care work, particularly hospital workers in Germany, was also important. So on March 8th itself, physical therapist in Charité, the largest public hospital in Berlin, went on strike, and they've been going on strike for about 4 weeks or so. And part of what the campaign said, as one healthcare worker relayed, quote, "When women stop working, the world stands still," end quote. Childcare workers also went on strike earlier this year in Germany, and they gathered a 400-person kind of contingent at noon at Robert Koch Platz in Berlin. A 31-year-old kindergarten teacher spoke about why she was fighting for the strike, and she said quote, "Because we want parents, students, and teachers to have a cleaner and better workplace." Moreover, the International Alliance contingent of that Frauenstreik, mostly comprised of women, transgender people, intersex people, met outside of the Justizvoll Zugangsstalt for Frauen in Berlin, which is the women's prison in the former East Berlin. And this action is particularly important because incarcerated women who were in part in prison because of self-defense for gender-based violence very much needed us out there to show our solidarity with these with them. And outside of that, activists made sure to honor their socialist feminist foremothers who helped to shape early 20th century feminism. So for example, the Die Linke Party left a rose for at Clara Zetkin's statue. So I bring these things up just to contrast them to the kind of very vicious scapegoaty language of the far right movements in Europe, to say that there's these other iterations and movements, and that specifically solidarity has been and has to be a central component of what it means to rebuild a feminist movement and a language that doesn't fulfill the service of the far right. It has to be intersectional and unapologetic, nuanced, and actually directly challenge these parties like AfD, especially in the context of people like myself who live in Germany and in Europe, and I'm not able to vote. So there has to be these other mechanisms, extra parliamentary, that can speak to these issues. So the growing international feminist tradition could also be a direct challenge, and similar to my previous panelists, I would agree that feminist scholars such as Cinzia Titti and Nancy Fraser have excavated vis-a-vis a very slim panel feminism for the 99%. They say, quote, "We are standing for all who are exploited, dominated, and oppressed. It aims to become a source of hope for the whole of humanity. That is why we call for 99%. end quote, feminism for the 99%, end quote. And at the time, the political test over the coming years is to develop open and transparent demands against Europe's growing far-right movements. And as a new generation of queers, feminists, gender non-binary people, etc., transgender women, speak to the concerns of labor, migration, and health and incarceration, feminism will have to explicitly distance itself from nationalism. And because feminist nationalism has, in my opinion, nothing to do with feminism, and it has and everything to do with ethno-nationalism, we have to rebuild and redesign a blueprint for our own liberation. Thank you.
Okay, hello everyone. My name is Ana Maria Šiša. I'm also from Croatia, the same as Marta, but I've been living in Slovenia for some time. And I am a young researcher and an assistant at the Faculty of Arts in Ljubljana, the Faculty of Social Sciences, in Ljubljana. And I'm doing my PhD in media studies. And my presentation won't be this case study. I can say that, but it's going to be more like a general research on couple form in capitalism and what is happening with couple form. So one of the biggest fears on the far right, especially by white men, is that we are faced with one of the fundamental changes of our time, that is the end of the long-term monogamous heterosexual relationship as a dominant couple form. And some on the liberal left are going even further and claim that we are also facing the end of courtship and the end of dating, relying only on instant hookups or sexual relations. And these are the changes which have supposedly left the new generation living on the ruins of romance, not willing to work to sustain and build intimate relationships and family ties. And these assumptions hold them, or better to say us, responsible for ending the supposedly ideal history of long-term partnership and nuclear family, sites of both affection and consumption at which our generation was raised. But we have to keep in mind that the couple form, the same as the nuclear family, are not ahistorical institutions, are forever changing, and it takes more than one single generation to mess these institutions up, although some of us would like to. And the problem is that we as a generation of millennials, the new precariat or whatnot, never had the chance to experience this so-called ideal. Most of us fell outside this dominant economic form, being the children of divorced, dead, violent, or poor parents, being rejected because of our queerness, or migrating and leaving our households at a very young age. Our reproduction was therefore individualized and not the best starting point for forming our own relationships and families, and the ones that did try mostly faced toxic relationships, isolation, tension, unhappiness, and inequality.
I'm sorry, I'm just gonna stop you for 1 second. I'm noticing a few people taking photos and video, and I just wanna make sure that everyone on the panel is comfortable with that.
Yeah.
Is that okay? Okay, thank you. Okay, no. So glad.
But thanks for that. But let's nevertheless take this hypothesis into consideration and say the end has come for all the long-term straight or gay intimate partnerships, which were, and some still struggle for it, for them to be the basis of nuclear family and the dominant couple form of the 20th century capitalism. And what does this end mean, or what will it represent in the future, and mainly whom can we hold responsible for it? So the end doesn't mean being liberated from the oppressive character of heterosexual relationships, which are constituted on women's unwaged reproductive and affective labor. The end also doesn't represent the end of love and authentic intimacy, or the end of intimate relationships as such. But it does reflect the basic transformation of contemporary capitalist society in the last 4 decades. The end basically means that couple and family forms have become a privilege, and that the field of pressure in intimate lives has expanded. This is especially true for proletarian youth, since we are still expected to couple and procreate, even though our living conditions are disabling us from doing so. And the end has materialized in casual dating, hanging out, hooking up, Netflix and chill, Tindering, sexting, in those ever multiplying forms of intimate engagement whose proliferation is being accelerated by shifting the sphere of dating from real life to the online big data driven economy that constructs algorithms in order to best sell you a perfect partner or enable you to purchase one. The classic form of taking someone out on a couple of dates, like dancing, cinema, drinks, etc., has now been replaced with various activities, and some of them don't include going out or being with the other person in the same room at all. They can be sexual, but they don't have to include any physical component of sex. Innumerable technologies and online platforms like online porn, Tinder, Grindr, Instagram, Bumble, Camgirls, private Snapchat accounts allows us to engage in forms of sex that leave the body untouched. Still, every one of these and many other forms of intimate friendships and relationships in that form in real life, such as friends with benefits, fuck buddies, or erotic friendships, have the potential of evolving to a steady or stable romantic relationship, something that used to be the usual scenario. But this is not the most common outcome. Instead, the most likely outcome of any particular hookup, hangout, or friendship is nothing. Nothing in a sense that there are no strings attached, that there exists a low level of commitment, supposedly followed by no tension, no expectation or explanations, and no planning of a common future. Most of these forms of intimate relationships tend to be short-lived, and becoming a couple in most of them is a least likely outcome. So we are witnessing the formation of new dominant emotional attitude. Moira Weigel calls it compulsory carelessness, and Margit Fields in her New York Times essay names it, and I like this pretty much, zen-like form of non-attachment, something psychologists would call commitment issue or phobia, assuming it is an individualized problem we face because of our weak or damaged psyche. Meeting a new potential partner means confronting your potential, for most of us, uncertain and unstable future over and over again. Therefore, thinking about our potential reproduction partners, not only for biological reproduction, but also the person with whom we are supposed to share everyday activities, or better to say domestic work, is most of the time also scary and unimaginable, since for us a stable and steady common life or future requires material security that is beyond our reach. So capital has therefore introduced us with a new norm, the proliferation of dating practices and ways of living, which must be fluid and flexible, but at the same time precarious and unstable, the same as our working conditions. The multiplication of dating practices has put dating on the forefront of reproduction strategies, as life courses have lost their linearity and clear transitions in between institutions of periods of life have been blurred and unclear. So no more this primary household, college, job, marriage, new household way of living. We are unable to make definite long-term goals. Those make us anxious and uncertain. We are coerced into making only short-term decisions which have immediate results and are part of a process of so-called personal growth or self-management, or as some like to call it, human capital. Take for example dating apps. In a short period, matchmaking sites have transformed into apps whose goal is to give us instant gratification, a date, a hookup, a short-term hype, and making us hooked on searching. Or on the other hand, they make easier ending the relationship by so-called ghosting, where all you have to do is stop all communication without ever explaining yourself or confront another. As capital terminates common patterns leading to a goal in a form of long-term partnership or family life, and this is what I would like to discuss later on, is this capital doing this? Is it something that capital wants? We remain focused on adjusting the process of searching, revising, and constantly self-assessing our strategies as no choice seems good enough for us. Defining the concept of dating has become extremely difficult because the meaning of the term has become so vague that it obscures the very thing it's supposed to capture. But our romantic relationship being short-lived is not what makes us anxious, nervous, or at times desperate. It is not being able to commit and build a relationship based on trust, not being able to express you want to commit or not wanting to commit, keeping your options open, not defining intimate relationships, and maintaining compulsory carelessness are all relational responses to the material conditions of possibility within the relatively narrow structural limits of capitalism. So here, I blame capital. Capital is like never before producing new forms of fears, insecurities, inequalities, and ways of suffering as it doesn't want stability and is destroying all forms of security. External limits on sexual and intimate experience are capital's work. So we have to ask ourselves, what are the living conditions of working class daters? First of all, we are facing widespread job precarity, mostly selling our particular skills in the gig economy for the so-called day job contracts or project contracts or monthly contracts, year contract, but a couple of years. Those jobs have relatively low payout, are jobs you cannot quit and don't offer you any kind of security in the form of paid holiday, access to pension or healthcare insurance. Employment is characterized by short-term, casual and precarious work, which with little real control or power available for the workers. Other than that, we are witnessing austerity, debts, and affordable housing markets, overall complete transformations in the way the work and the leisure are organized. But most of our working class generation was never familiar with the concept of security. For example, I could only compare it with my parents' life. Being in your late 20s or early 30s means you have shared your everyday life with around 20 flatmates, had as much working arrangements and change almost as many intimate or romantic partners or more. Traditional expectations of employment, welfare, pension, and security in everyday life were never our options. We grew up not knowing. Having a job or a work contract most of the time means only constantly thinking about the next one. The same is with potential partners. The present one can only be a good one, but there is no guarantee that it will last, so you must secure yourself with other possible options. If a job or a partner can materialize at any time and from anywhere and must be grabbed instantly before the competition, can a worker ever not be poised in anticipation of the next job or a partner? Which brings us to the next question, and that is what capital want. What is the logic or the magical thinking or sorcery of capitalism that is changing our lives, including our intimacy and sexuality? So in my opinion, first, there is the effect of permanent structural instability or the cancellation of the long term, as Mark Fisher calls it. And although it is capital's desire to provoke innovation and bold entrepreneurial leaps, the main effects that predominate in the late capitalism are fear and anxiety. The psychological and subjective dimension of the capitalist economy, desire, expectations, everyday enthusiasm, but also fear and anxiety, despair, are nevertheless all extremely important. What capital strives for is a constant experimentation and adaptation of our lifestyles, personal identities and intimacy, all of which should have the effect of infinite innovation and the increase of productivity, even if for the most of us it means suffering. In what Foucault names neoliberal governmentality, it is competition that drives the process of infinite innovations, especially technological ones. But competition is not limited only to capitalist institutions and enterprises. It has spread its tentacles to the working class lives in a specific way. We are dealing with an extension of market rationality to all forms of existence through the generalization of the enterprise form. Its goal is to eventually change, how Thatcher famously put it, the heart and the soul of the workers. So in neoliberalism, our souls are constantly changing by transformation in production relations, uncertainty, exposure to risk, and competitiveness. We are coerced to actively work in our competitiveness and are being held directly responsible for our living conditions and intimate lives. We are the only ones that can make our lives better and happier, supposedly. In a situation when everyone is replaceable and no one is everlasting, the easiness of withdrawing and replacing either workers, jobs, partners, things or apartments becomes simultaneously the motivation for productivity and innovation and the basis of suffering. And although we could consider that the multiplication of sexual desires, dating practices, and forms of reproduction in its short-term flexible form represent a liberation from inequality of long-term monogamous heterosexual partnerships, and in some cases it does, we should be careful, as capital will never self-abolish couple or family, couple form or family, and is only making room for putting more pressure on the ones already in the most precarious positions, making more room for exploitation and the individualization of care and effective work. Most of us have been focusing on the process of survival, as all the opportunities leading to a middle-class life are being lifted out of our reach. That still doesn't mean that we want to go back to the dominant form, because nostalgia for the good old times pervades only in the hearts of privileged ones, those who were or still are at the receiving end of reproductive labor but remain blind to its workings. Okay, thanks.